Today's program has been brought to you by Calavita. Think outside the bottle with Calavita, America's trusted family brand, makers of extra virgin olive oil and fine Italian food products. Calavita.com.
Today's program has been brought to you by Wines of Bordeaux. Visit their website at bordeaux.com.
This is Sherry Bayer from All in the Industry. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Food Talk. Michael Lemeku here. Early February, really cold day. It finally feels like winter here in New York City today. It's cold. The air is cold and dry and blowing. I've been on my bicycle all day, so my voice ain't all there. We'll see how far we can go in this show. I've got that dry winter, shouldn't be on my bicycle all day voice, but I am on my bicycle inhaling that cold air going in and out. But I've got a great guest today, someone who I've been meaning to get on the radio for some time. I asked, David Lilly is my guest today. He's the proprietor of Chamber Street Wines in downtown Manhattan and Tribeca. Really, really one of the great wine stores in the city. Complete favorite with somms and wine lovers. I think when you ask anybody that I take seriously, you know, where they shop or if they can name the five best wine stores in New York City, it's pretty much on everybody's short list. He's got a long career in wine. I could have sworn I had him on the radio when I was at WOR, but apparently not. Maybe, who knows? Maybe we don't remember. Anyway, great to have you, David.
Thank you, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's do this because, stories always exist in the context of something. So when did you get to New York? You're born and raised here or from elsewhere?
No. Born and raised in Virginia, outside of Washington. Family was from Vermont and from Boston. So how did I wind up here? I was in Vermont playing music, growing apples and then playing music, and moved to New York to expand the musical group to work out of New York. That was in 77.
So you've been here before me. Good for you. What rock music? What were you doing? Punk?
No.
Yeah, classical? Right.
By that time, we were doing 100% swinging jazz from the 30s, 40s, 50s. It was a nine-piece group recreating what we felt were the best musical giants of that era. Lot of Ellington, Benny Carter, Fletcher Henderson.
Classic
AC.
Stuff. Yeah, swing. Four bop.
Swing, but rearranged, and then some of our own compositions. We did a lot of late Ellington, which is great stuff that people don't hear much these days. And the band went on for about 15 years, but with three kids and arts funding drying up and not as many jazz festivals, nightclubs didn't pay enough for nine people. Yeah. So I was looking for something somehow to make money in a hurry. And that was wine.
Retail.
Wine retail, oddly enough, yeah.
At Garnett. That was the first gig.
First gig. I wandered in the door.
What led you there?
I mean, just poverty, really. So,
because there wasn't. So I got to New York in 82, and by, within a couple of years, I was making okay money. I mean, whatever that meant. But back then, first growths, Burgundy, Bordeaux, were actually kind of affordable.
Sure.
Compared to today. Yeah. Even on like a cook salary, you could go in and buy, for the high teens back then, really, stuff now that costs, move the decimal over, maybe twice.
Right. Yeah, at least.
Right?
Yeah.
And there weren't that many stores. I lived on the Upper West Side, and I remember it was 67th, Ackle Merle. Morel was always a sort of a powerhouse. I forget where they were in Midtown East. Garnett on the East Side. But, I mean, there just was, in terms of retail locations, there weren't that many. And Garnett was really key because of Joe Dresner.
That came later. In the early days, Garnett was an intense discounter, perhaps right. The first to heavily discount Bordeaux, Champagne, Bill Carsemel for, $17, whatever it was back then. Really vast quantities of that kind of wine. So when I first got there, I was studying Robert Parker, who was in the early days of his power. So I was studying The Wine Advocate. As I was doing my last month on a cruise ship with the band, I was studying The Wine Advocate, I have to admit.
We were all young and stupid once.
I don't remember when Joe Dressner walked into the store. It was probably in 89 or 90, I'm guessing. He was selling Burgundy. He had gotten some allocations from Paul Pernod and some other people.
His wife was...
Denise was from the Macon.
Right, and they had a house in the Macon. The story goes that they would go there every year. And as they traveled around, found wineries that weren't represented in the States that he thought, I think we could do this.
There were journalists at the time, and I think they were looking for another way to make a living, and that it seemed possible. So he came to the store selling Burgundy, and he had a sample of Domaine de la Pepiere, Muscadet, because one of their growers in Beaujolais, I think it was Jean-Paul Brun, who they had just started with.
He was the guy that Jean-Paul Brun here.
And he had met Marc Olivier of Pepiere, so there was a sample, and J.R. at Garnett, my longtime friend there, said, "Oh, you should taste with David. That's his department." And the wine was terrific. I said, "I'll take 50 cases," and that was a relationship was born.
But what was your department? At that point,
I was buying
light whites from the Loire Valley.
I was buying Spain and Portugal, and I forget where else, but also the Loire Valley, the Rhone. And they were letting me just develop the Loire Valley as my little playground, so it was great.
What year? 80s?
Well, starting in 86, I started buying directly from people with the 89 vintage, which was propitious, from Bernard Baudry, from Louvetry and Muscadet, through an agent in the Loire Valley. And that led me to a lot of contacts up and down the Loire, which I then shared with Joe when we started traveling together.
And he had a really, just a unique voice, really kind of an eclectic, and I mean that literally and figuratively, like his opinions, his writing, his blogging, his whatever, because now, sadly, he passed young. I mean, we lost him, what, 6-7 years ago to cancer?
Yeah.
But he was really like a figure and kind of a guy that was early in that space of natural wines and very opinionated, but not in a doctrinaire didactic way. He just sort of followed his palate.
He was a brilliant guy who tasted extremely well, much better than me, I would have to say. Very able to pinpoint what was good and bad about a wine, to know what he liked. But he was one of his main talents was with the winemakers. He was so personable and so able to relate to them very quickly and with great humor, and they really appreciated that. I mean, watching him warm up a winemaker that we had met for the first time over a space of a few hours was always a fabulous experience.
So I'm trying to think who else. Neil Rosenthal hadn't started yet. Kermit Lynch was
Rosenthal was working.
And Kermit Lynch.
Lynch was already in very, very important. I think what Joe realized early on was how important organic farming, natural yeasts, wild yeast, I should say, hand harvesting, and we as the first trips he and I took together, I think he was more aware of this more immediately than I was. I was just sort of like, okay, can I sell this or not? But it became clear to both of us that the wines we liked shared these components. We didn't go there looking, only for organic wines. We didn't have this program that we were, very narrowly focused on this. Tasting the wines opened us up to that and made us realize that this is what we wanted. So we then began to use those as parameters when we were looking for winemakers.
That was prescient. I mean, without seeming like I'm patting you on the back, that was really early in that space.
I would have to say that Kermit Lynch was already doing that. I don't think he ever, chose to go solely towards organic and biodynamic farming, but it's a big part of his portfolio even today.
And being in the Loire back then, because Loire is a funny place. I mean, you maybe agree, maybe disagree, but if I go back in my head, like take Anjou, you go back 25 years or so, and it was just so much overproduced, overcropped, chaptalized shit coming out of Anjou. To excuse my French, they didn't give a shit. There wasn't a proud tradition of limiting production of, they were just
Muscadet was the main example of that, probably because there was, starting in the 60s, there was enormous overproduction when they were first able to go totally mechanized in the vineyards, totally chemical in the vineyards, just started making wine with lots of sugar, inoculated with yeast and everything else. And it was cheap, and they sold tons of it very successfully. But then when competition came in from South Africa, from South America, those markets dried up, and they were left in a very bad situation. But happily, there were a handful of people in Muscadet who kept on working with the old ways, with the old traditions, and, you know, gradually. And there's fabulous terroir there. Muscadet is a region that capable of making very great wines. And for me, as a musician, of course, you could buy them cheaply, so that was an attraction for me.
Still is a great. I mean, there's still so much value in the Loire.
Yeah, I mean, everyone's basic cuvée still sells for 15 or less, and the wines can be very, very good.
Yeah, and you can get into the low 20s and find remarkably good wines, just bigger and fleshier and rounder, and, you know, more meat on the bones. And then, you know, we'll go in a little bit and talk about Cab Franc later on, but, you know, we've had Pascaline on the show a bunch of times. She's a friend. And so you just got back. So everyone, you know, we live on Facebook now. We're, you know, I got dragged into this century reluctantly with the whole social media thing, but I have to because of TV and funding and, you know, interacting with the audience or whatever the hell that's supposed to mean. But anyway, one does these things. Mm-hmm. But then it is kind of fun, like Pascaline's feed on Instagram and Facebook the last 3 weeks. She's just been, everyone says she did the Loire. So you were there too. The last week of January into the first couple of days of February, there's like, what, six or seven?
Six trade shows in and around Angers and Saumur for all of the natural, organic, and biodynamic and the various little compartments that they put themselves into. My favorite show actually was the last one, which combined the Demeter biodynamic show, a show called La Levée de la Loire, which is the organic, old-time organic people, with the old Salon Vin de Loire, which is everybody in the Loire Valley. But so people that go to the biodynamic show, well, let's take Joe Landron, for instance, at Domaine Louvetry. The best place to taste with him was at the old traditional Salon Vin de Loire because it's quiet and he has all his wine there and the other shows are very crowded. But the biodynamic show there's one in Angers and there was another one at the Salon outside, so there were two of them. But fabulous opportunity to taste with hundreds and hundreds of the best organic natural wine producers in France. Absolutely a great experience.
And the Loire, I think, is because the price of land, even to this day, is still relatively reasonable. I say relatively because obviously you look at Bordeaux and Burgundy, and no one can go in there that isn't a billionaire.
So you're talking about Anjou, which has great terroir, but was primarily producing sweet whites, demi-sec whites, which of course don't sell anymore. So that there's been a drop in vineyard prices, and there are so many young people now making terrific wines in Anjou, reds and whites, dry whites, many with no sulfur, all of them organic. It's just a hotbed of activity now. It's great.
We just, this past year, for the PBS series, we were in Alsace last May. Then we were in Sicily a couple of weeks later. It was food and wine, but mostly wine was the focus. And then in September, we were in Bordeaux. Of course, totally different worlds there. But Alsace was remarkable for me, too, with the, you know, we were. I remember one afternoon we had a picnic with Umbrecht Josmeyer, Ostertag, up on the Rangen slopes.
Oh, nice group.
Nice group of guys, right? Like these young gun guys, and we had this long discussion. I guess because of the Alsace's proximity to Germany. I mean, it's land that's sort of gone back and forth between the French and the Germans in terms of whose it was. Kind of looks Germanic, feels Germanic. Great varietals are very much Germanic. Shape of the bottle, the fact that they put the actual varietal on the label. There's a lot of confusion within the American market with Alsace. But it's a different style of fermentation, as you know. The Rieslings are super, super crisp, super dry, almost no residual sugar. But I was surprised at how popular Bio was. And, you know, they said it's because, you know, look, we're sort of culturally in between the Germans, and Steiner had this influence that we really felt farming, that this was how we wanted to to do the land.
It's also because it's the easiest region of France to in which to be organic, because the rainfall, you don't think of it, but Alsace is quite dry and very sunny.
Yep.
So
Colmar, which is the heart of it, I think sees it's the second driest city in France. Right. There's a mountain range that just protects everything, holds everything away from them.
But it's still very difficult to sell. You take Pierre Frick, for example, who's a brilliant biodynamic winemaker. Many of his cuvées without sulfur. There are so many different cuvées that and they're different every year. He's not consistent one year to the next. So for the consumer, it's a challenge. It's worth doing, but it's a challenge.
Well, this is so everywhere I go. In the last year, it was three different regions of the world. We didn't have this discussion so much in Bordeaux because there wasn't. I mean, we did visit producers that were cleaner and either bio or getting there or going to be certified, but it's a much smaller percentage in terms of overall production.
Bordeaux is sort of a wasteland, really. I'm sure.
It's the right bank is kind of exciting in a way because you've got some smaller family producers there that are taking chances that aren't. I mean, the left bank is what it is, right, for the most part. But I ask everyone the same question. I ask the guys up on the hill. I ask those three guys about this, about sulfuring white wine, especially white wines. Mm-hmm. And I remember Umbeck, the big guy, you know, he's like 6'5" with those big hands. And he's like, you know, big inhale, exhale. He says, Mike, you know, it's a dream for me, but it's a dream. You know, I feel that we're growing. I mean, we're using everything clean. We're bio and organic in terms of all of the growth. We're hand harvesting everything. My vineyards look super healthy. But if I'm going to ship wine to the United States, vintage to vintage, I want it to be consistent within that vintage from case to case, from bottle to bottle, in as much as we can. And if I feel that we're using just the minimal amount of sulfur. If I don't have that stabilization, it's like I'm sending out a science experiment. And this is interesting, and everyone kind of rolls their eyes. And what's your take? Because you can't answer the question with your comment before.
I think there's a growing number of people who are willing to put in the effort, the challenge of drinking natural wines. And I mean, you use the word, I don't like the word natural, but let's say it's a wine with little or no sulfur. And there are a lot of advantages to the wine itself. I mean, you get a clarity, you get a mineral expression. And if the winemaker has avoided the pitfalls of no sulfur winemaking and gotten it into the bottle without too much a reductive character or that sort of mousy finish, which can be present in many of the wines, for a big producer like Zinhombrecht, they just can't do it. But for someone like Pierre Frick, if we're staying in Alsace, he's able to experiment and make a number of no-sulfur cuvées. And yes, the consumer has to carafe the wine. I mean, you just have to. You don't just pop it and drink it.
You can't.
It takes.
You've got to blow off those VAs.
It's a whole category of wine that needs some, shall we say, some work, some energy from the consumer, which is sort of an interesting concept. It's not usually part of the deal. You buy a bottle, you open it, and you drink it. You don't think about it. I just tasted a rosé from Traguiner in Collioure. There's little or no sulfur. It's sort of cloudy looking, and when you open the bottle, it's very reductive. And I'm thinking, I can't sell this unless. So in my notes, I say warning.
Decant an hour before, or something.
If you take that care, it becomes a really very, very interesting and delicious wine. But you know, it's not easy. Part of the work of making no sulfur wines is in the vineyard, and that's something that people perhaps don't realize as much as they might. At the Big Glue coming up at the end of the month, we're doing a seminar on living wines from living soils. I think it's called, The Role of Agriculture in Producing Natural Wines. Eric Texier will be there.
Wow.
Tom Luby will be there. I think one or two other winemakers, perhaps Pascaline. We're going to talk about what people are doing in the soil, how long-time organic and biodynamic farming can lead the raisins, the grapes, to actually have more of the micronutrients, more of the chemical ability to resist spoilage.
Naturally,
which can make making wine without sulfur much easier. I mean, if a guy that's been farming that way for a long time, or for example, let's say in Macon Cruzy, those guys Julien Guyot at the Vignes du Maine. They've, since the 50s, have never applied anything on their soils. I mean, these are living soils. And he says, I don't need to use sulfur. He uses a little in the whites, 10 milligrams, maybe 15, zero in the reds, and he thinks it's because the wine is so naturally able to defend itself from oxidation. I mean, there's a natural level of 30 to 40 milligrams in many of these wines without adding anything.
Yeah, it's funny. When you know, Chris Strzok used to work at Racine,
mm-hmm.
right? Fun. I love it. Really fun guy. Really, youthful, energetic. Really loves wine. He was on the show a couple of weeks ago, and he brought in a bottle of wine from Georgia. I forget the varietal, Czechielecki, whatever those things are called. I don't remember what it was, but it was done in a Quervy, completely mm-hmm. natural, mm-hmm. like that style of the Alice Firing loves, the Légeron, that everyone's kind of. And I have to tell you, it was. He's. I guess this was the sixth or seventh bottle that he's opened with someone. They've all been a little different. And he said this was the best. It was just the high-toned fruit on the nose was unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Like, he poured this guy, I was like, what the hell? And then, of course, one of those amber wines. They call them amber wines. On the skin, on gross leaves for 6 months, 9 months. Really tannic. I mean, I'm not sure food pairing where I'm going to go with this wine, but it was bloody delicious. But my point is, if you think about, like, the history of winemaking, like in the Georgian Caucasus, they've been doing this for, 3,000-4,000 years, in this same style of, it's natural, the yeast occurs naturally on the grape, we grow the grapes, we're farmers, we take care of the land, we pick, we crush, boom, gravity, gone into the Quervy, we stir it around a little bit, and it comes out 6 or 9 months later as wine. That's how, I mean, that was winemaking up until, I guess, the middle of the last century. Mm-hmm. And then everywhere, people just began to get into fertilizers for the soil.
Had to do something with all that phosphorus after the war, after all.
And phylloxera, so everyone just suddenly, the French, everyone just embraced this idea of chemicals and fertilizers and spraying, and it just became kind of rote. But before that, it didn't exist. It really was the middle of the last century. And when I talked to the producers in Bordeaux, they said, Mike, really, before World War II, we weren't even doing much aging in barrique. I mean, that's like a modern style of Bordeaux. The idea that, I mean, we would just make wine and in larger formats and release it. The idea of 24 months, 36 months en barrique in new oak, and that's very, we think of it as like it's been going on forever. That's actually relatively modern.
Yeah. Well, you look at Claude Rougeard in Sommer Champigny, he's the most famous red wine producer in the Loire Valley. He actually claims that that's the way wines were made prior to World War II in the Loire, the red wines, that they were in, not new barrique, but they were in barrel for 2 to 3 years and had that sort of concentration, and then that whole tradition was lost. But in Bordeaux, I have to agree with you. It's... There's so little wine there now that interests me in terms of the way it's currently being made. There's a guy way up in the northern Médoc called Plonquet. His name is Didier Michaud, who's got 3 hectares, and everything is incredibly natural in the vines. The winemaking is, as you say, totally simple, nothing added, old barrels for 2 years, and no manipulation whatsoever. And the wine is brilliant, but there aren't many wines like that. Mostly Cabernet with Merlot, with old clone of Petit Verdot. That's okay. Very interesting. And there's some biodynamic folks in the Côte de Blaye.
You still have it at the store? You have it at the store?
We do. We just got the 2012 vintage. It's around $18 or $19.
No,
and it's very good.
Way. Yeah. I have trouble with you. I've got a bicycle with a big basket on the front, and the basket's clumsy enough. I got one of those big ass baskets the delivery guys use because I saw them with it, and I'm like, I shop for food, I shop for wine. The small baskets don't hold enough, so I went to my bike store on Grand Street. Been there forever, and I told the guy there, and the owner looked at me, and he says, "They're really heavy, Mike, those baskets." And I said, "Well, I'm really heavy. I don't care. If I'm a big guy, I got a big bike. Who cares?" I didn't know. You ever on a bicycle?
Not anymore.
Well, anyway, it was like $50. This thing cost me a bunch. But he puts it on, and literally, like, he hands me the bike, and I'm like, oh, fuck. It's like, you can't even steer this thing. It's like 9 pounds, and it's up by the handlebars. And it just makes driving so difficult. The good news is I drive much more carefully than I used to on my bicycle, so I'm probably better off long-term. But it holds a ton of wine. But I had to come by your store with a car and get a couple of cases. But yeah, so I've noticed this too, and I talk, what's the woman, Legeron? She's a master of wine.
Isabel Legeron. Doing the raw fares in London. And
yeah, we had her on the show here. We had her on the show here this past
fall.
Might
be coming to New York.
Brilliant. Obviously, master of wine. She's got a encyclopedic knowledge and a palate to back it up. But real proponent of natural wines. We talked about that. There is something, and I travel with. I mean, love talking to people like you and Pascaline. Lots of Somme friends. Wine is what I drink for dinner every night. I like to travel around it. If I'm going someplace, we're going to do the wine thing too. But there is something about those wines that's alive, and I've noticed the more I drink them, that when I go back to more traditional, I don't want to say factory wines, but you know, producers that are maybe not using natural yeast, producers that are just kind of making a very nice product, but there's a kind of a deadness to it, like a sameness to it. And I open these bottles of wine that are, and it's like, they're literally alive. They'll change from glass to glass throughout the bottle. They'll change sometimes within the glass from the beginning to the end. And there's just an energy to them. And everyone says, there is some way, because of the lack of manipulation, because of the indigenous yeast, because it's not being just non-interventionist all the way, it lets the kind of the wine's voice come through.
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, some of it's as basic as hand harvesting. Because if you're harvesting by machine, you're getting fruit that's damaged.
There's no selection. Oxidizing.
So you've got to dump a bunch of sulfur in there to clean it up. So you're already kind of screwed from the beginning. Then you need to dump in a bunch of yeast because you've killed off the natural yeasts. Then you got to dump in a bunch of enzymes and whatever to bacteria for the mallow. I mean, there's so many things that a product, a modern wine goes through. So yeah, by the time it gets to you, it's one dimensional. It's a little bit dead, and it's the same. And that's all very nice for mass produced wines. That's fine. But I think that was the first thing that Joe and I hit on in the early years was hand harvesting and wild yeast, because that made such a difference. We didn't really get into the organic farming for another year or two, or you know, the lower amounts of sulfur. But meeting people, one of the first visits was I think with Thévenet at Domaine Bongrand in Mâcon. It's not a really well known estate, but he's been working that way all along. And to visit him in maybe 1990 or whenever it was a real eye opener for me. Like, wow, this guy is farm. Look at his farming. You know, this is does not look like what anybody else is doing.
Shit growing
and,
everywhere.
Yeah, and now it's what so many people are doing. Right. And for me, you go visit someone like Christian Ducroux in Regnier. Here's a guy that's got the most beautiful vineyards in the Beaujolais. I mean, he's got fruit trees every five rows. He's taken out a row of vines to plant fruit trees. He's got natural stuff growing everywhere, and he really knows what's growing and what's doing for his soil. So he knows, you know, what they're bringing to the soil. And he's working without sulfur really super carefully. I mean, he sold off – a lot of these guys are selling off property so that they get down to 5 hectare, 4 hectare, because that's what they can handle either by themselves or with one helper. They can bottle it super carefully or by hand. So you can actually get the wine into the bottle without sulfur or with minimal sulfur. And for him, for guys like this, it's not a commercial thing at all. And that's what draws me to them, I guess. You know, as a musician, I was never, I mean, I loved wine and it was a way to make a living. But when I see these growers, they're so far away from the commercial wine world. And what they're doing is so, it's just so artistic, but it's also important. It's important in an international scale because guys like this are showing that you can farm commercially with these kind of methods and grow a product and get more money for it and survive economically. And you saw this was even in the New York Times 3 or 4 days, maybe last week, an article about cover crops in industrial farming. A number of guys in the Midwest farming the way some of our organic friends in their vineyards are farming and showing their neighbors, I'm getting more bushels, I'm getting better quality, I'm spending zero on chemicals. Yes, it's more labor-intensive, it's more time-consuming, but in the end, it pays. So, I mean, this kind of farming, this whole outlook, you know, it's of international importance. The UN has been getting behind this in the third world, trying to encourage people to go away from the American or international-led chemical farming mafia.
Right.
And
monocrop.
Break out of it.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, They're showing that small farms working organically, working with older methods, are actually producing more food for more people, and that this is really the answer going forward, not what we're being told with, of course, the genetically modified plants so that they can withstand more Roundup and more chemicals and more, I mean, this sort of, you know, nonsensical conglomeration of chemicals. So a very important person in Europe for this is Claude Bourguignon. Have you
no.
read his book at all?
No.
Wrote a book in France maybe 8 or 9 years ago. Has not been translated into English, but I think it will be. It's called Les Champs à la Terre, something else. I've read it twice, but I don't remember the title. Lydia and Claude Bourguignon. It's both a complete primer of soil science, I mean, really thorough biology of the soil, and it shows you in great detail how what's happening in the soil affects the plants living on the surface, again, in great scientific detail. And then he relates that to the products we eat, whether it's wine, whether it's cheese, whether it's dairy or meat, you know, how those things are affected by this kind of farming. And it's a brilliant book that should be in wider circulation.
Yes, it's, you know, you're talking, I think actually Pasqualine took a picture of that book, because again, mm-hmm. Facebook recently,
right.
And I was like, I Googled it, and there is no English translation, and I read French, and I'm like, right. Fuck, someone's going to translate that into English or read it to me. But, you know, back to Beaujolais, where you were just talking, so, I mean, you were in Mâcon, so we're just south of Burgundy, really almost parallel to the northern cruise of Beaujolais, and the yeast discussion, and then you think, you know, like, I don't think people, you know, consumers realize how much, and I guess Dubuff is like the poster child for this. I mean, George Dubuff, right. in a way, helped Beaujolais kind of become a brand in an innocent way. You know, he was a big promoter of the region, of course, the Beaujolais Nouveau and that whole release. But you taste every one of Dubuff's wines, and it's that one commercial yeast. It just tastes like bananas.
Well, he was a talented – is he still alive? He's a talented guy. He did a lot to, you know, raise awareness of the Beaujolais,
correct.
For sure. I mean, he was featured in Parker all the time. And there were wines made there that were actually quite good in that style. That, I mean, the, you know, the top vineyards. I have to admit that, you know, I was buying those wines in the late 80s until I started tasting
Brun.
Wild yeast, yeah. Jean-Paul Brun, and LaPierre was of yeah. enormous importance. I mean, everyone knows this, but it's really a fact. LaPierre and the people around him who knew Jules Chauvet and sort of developed that whole way of making Beaujolais that was the semi-carbonic,
right.
with wild yeasts, with minimal sulfur. I mean, Chauvet was not so dogmatic, you know. He would add sulfur. He would add sugar if you had to. I mean, it's...
Is Brun semi-carbonic or he's Burgundian?
Brun is Burgundian.
Yeah, he's Burgundian.
Yeah.
He's crushed.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, LaPierre's wines and the wines of that group got to the Loire Valley, were tasted by Pierre Breton, for instance. I mean, Breton knew him. I mean, Breton was enormously important in the Loire Valley. He's actually coming to New York for his 30th anniversary of his domain, which will be in a couple of weeks at Racine, which will be great fun. But I was
private
there.
Private event again?
It's a private event. They're right, inviting yes. Trade people,
yes,
but
yes,
it's
yes.
He will be around. He will be at the Big Glue, so you can taste with Pierre Breton at the Big Glue in Williamsburg at the White Hotel, which is Saturday and Sunday at the end of the month. And on Sunday, there's also Les Vins Libres at Racine, which is 22 natural winemakers at Racine on Chamber Street. That's on Sunday. And then there's a dinner on Monday, I believe it's the 29th, with those growers.
We'll talk about Racine. I love Racine. You're involved with Racine, and it's a great project. I remember way back in the early days when I was a young New York chef, you know, food was all my life, so my summer vacations were always go to France and eat.
Right.
We got 3 weeks off, and you tried, if, you know, a lot of the big restaurants closed traditionally, the summer is slow time in Europe, but you'd make your reservations for, you know, for Germain, for Taïwan, for, you know, Marc Menot, for wherever you wanted to go, those big ticket ones, and then in the nights in between, you'd just hit the fun bistros. And I remember, like, Willie's Wine Bar, the early pioneers, and, you know, going there and just drinking these wines that then you couldn't get those wines in the States.
Right.
Those early wine bars were kind of great. And then the wine bar thing in this, it came to America. And up until pretty recently, I mean, I love them because they're a great chance to buy the glass, go with three or four friends, and maybe do 12 or 13 different glasses that you're kind of sharing and pouring, and you're only committing to 4 ounces at a time, so big deal, and you get to learn and take notes and remember. But the food in these places was always basically kind of picnic food. I mean, Right. Wine bars were generally that you were there for the wine, you weren't there for the beet salad with the goat cheese or whatever it was. That was what you could eat. But then you have a place like yours, Le Cressine, that's just fucking full on. That chef's a badass.
The chef is a genius. It was not really what we had in mind when with the concept of Racine. We were sort of going for the original Racine at the Passage Panorama,
right,
in Paris.
Which was tiny.
And some places that I like. There's a place in Villiers-Morgon that's just an amazing wine bar restaurant. That's every Beaujolais you could possibly want to drink for €3 a glass, which is sort of like heaven, I think. But when Frederick arrived, it became obvious that we had a genius on our hands. So, okay, it's going to be fine dining. So it is a fine dining establishment that's also a wine bar with reasonable prices, with a really interesting list. My partner, Arnaud Tronche, has done a great job with
that's a great
the bottle list.
It's a great list.
And the glass list is always interesting. We'll have some Gonon Saint-Joseph there within a week or two, which is nice. But yeah, it's sort of a challenge. I mean, it's a challenge in New York because of real estate prices to do what you can do. I mean, in Paris, okay, it's less expensive. So I mean, to run a restaurant in New York and keep the wines by the glass at $6 or $8 is not so easy. My son is actually going to try it on 14th Street. There's a place called Vert de Terre, which means glass of earth and also means earthworm, the most important creature in the soil.
Where are 14th, east or west?
West side near 7th Avenue. Okay. Should be opening maybe by April, but he really wants to serve a young crowd and keep the glass prices very low and have an all-natural selection. Should be very interesting.
And food. Yeah, so I'm thinking like a 10 bells.
The food will be – he's actually lined up with the guy that runs Dirty Bird. Do you know these places?
I've heard of them, yes.
It's very good. It's great quality chicken. So he's got a place on 14th.
Yeah, he does. Tiny one.
Yeah, so he's opening the wine bar next door to it. Should be interesting.
All right, we're going to take a break. Liz, we're going to take a break. Let's play some spots here. Thank you, Liz. These are people that help bring this show and others like it to Heritage. We'll be right back after this. Folks, Mike Hillimeco here. Everybody knows that great cooking really starts with great ingredients, and these days we have so many options to choose from. Well, I go back to the Colavita family brand for years, and there really is a Colavita family behind this brand. I got their story long after I started using their products. Back in the mid-80s, when I was the chef at the Ritz-Carlton here in New York City, one of the things you can do as a chef is order your own food. You do the purchasing, and we switched olive oils to Colavita. When I had my own restaurant down in Cape May, New Jersey, the Globe, for years, that's all we ever poured at the table. That's all I ever cooked with. And then when I started my PBS show in 1999, I thought, if I'm going to look after underwriting and funders, why don't I go after products that I actually use at home, that I actually cook for my family with and in my restaurant with. I've been working with them for 15 years with the PBS series and now with Heritage Radio. The Colavita family goes back generations in Italy. They make their olive oil from great sourced olives, traceable source olives, just south of Rome in Molise province, Abruzzo, which is where my family hails from. Since then, their family's moved here, so there's Colavitas living in Rome, Colavitas living in America. It's a great, trusted family brand. It's the olive oil I use, and I'd recommend you try it as well. So if you listen to the show, you know I am a wine lover. We get sommeliers here all the time. We get winemakers. I've been drinking wine with dinner since before most of you were born. And when you think of the great wine regions of the world, I mean, what comes to mind? Bordeaux, Burgundy, Champagne, Piedmont? Yeah, okay. Well, I just got back from Bordeaux. Was there for the crush for the 2015 harvest, and I was thrilled to see, A, how the city of Bordeaux has transformed itself. It's so alive, it's so beautiful, and the region itself is crazy. There's a whole new generation of young vignerons who are coming in, and they're not making your grandfather's Bordeaux anymore. Young farmers, young vignerons that have been there for generations, that know the soil, that know the grapes, and what grapes are we talking about? We're pretty familiar here. Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Cab Franc, Petit Verdot, Malbec, all of those grapes find themselves in these blends. But the new style of Bordeaux wines are super fresh, super young, super clean, meant to be consumed now, not cellared for decades, because really, who has a cellar? The whites are super great. I think they're super undervalued and appreciated. Semillon, Sauvignon Blanc, crisp, dry, all stainless. If there's a little oak integration, you barely feel it. And the reds come in all sorts of styles. You know, the left bank is a little more Cabernet Sauvignon heavy, a little more structured, a little more tannic. The right bank with more Merlot tends to be fruity, a little more opened up, receives you a little bit easier. But if you've been walking past that Bordeaux aisle in your wine store, stop and grab a bottle. From $15 to $35 is some of the best value on planet Earth. With wines that are growing in one of the great wine regions, vignerons that are passionate, they know what they're doing. Give Bordeaux a second shot. I love the wines. Okay, we're back. Hey, we're back with my guest, David Lilly, who is the proprietor of Chambers Street Wines, which, again, if you live in the tri-state area or if you live in Manhattan, even better. It's one of the great stores. My son's really into wine. We go out at least once or twice a week, and he's become, because we go out to eat a lot, and I love wine, he's like become like the total wine geek kid. But like, that's, he spends all his money. I want to get him down to you, because he lives in Queens. He lives in Astoria, Long Island City, and he takes the subway in, and he fell in love with Flatiron. And I'm like, dude, if you like Flatiron, you're really like Chambers Street, because it's like they got a Xerox of... Not there's anything wrong with that, but it's like... It's a really good store, but just stay on the subway a little longer.
It's go a very nice store.
Few stops further south and go to Chambers Street. You know, one of the other, we're going to switch gears slightly, only because I want to give you props for this. One of the things that, because I am not that frequent. I used to live in the West Village, which was north of you. So I had a couple of stores that were kind of like my go-to places. Now I'm in the Lower East Side, and there's Discovery Wine down by me, which is kind of a nice little spot. So I don't get over to you enough either, but I was in your store a while back, and I'm looking, and I'm usually in the Loire section, to be honest with you. Or in the Gamay Beaujolais section, right? But then an aisle further north, there's these older vintage Barolos and Barbarescas. Barolos, mostly.
Both. Yeah.
And reasonably priced. So you're looking at wines that are 15, 20, 30, in some cases 35 to 40 years old, yeah, that are priced in and around $100 a bottle. Sometimes a little less, sometimes a little more. And what is even more interesting for me, and you know, is you guarantee the wines. So if somebody takes those wines home and, it's cooked, it's corked, it's gone, okay.
Right. But, I mean, who's going to buy them if you don't do that? I mean, if you argue with the consumer about every bad bottle, I mean, it's not a good way to do business. So you have to build in enough margin so that, I mean, I had to encourage my partner to cooperate, but Jamie Wolf, who has made these fantastic connections in Italy with agents that are purchasing cellars that are providing him with these older wines. And they are, you know, he's super careful about who he buys from. The wines are in good condition. And yes, you know, we guarantee them. So if you have a bad bottle, you get a credit. It seems a little crazy to give someone a credit on a 1971 Barolo, but for $300. But otherwise, you can't do this business. So, I mean, we do enough of it, so it works out. I mean, obviously we're not making huge margins on these wines in the end with the number of bad bottles. But, you know, if you buy the wine, if someone in the wine business actually bought one and 4 years later said to us, oh, well, it wasn't good. Excuse me, wait. You had it for 4 years, and
yeah, right,
where
right.
did you have it? Right. I had it in my house.
In your house,
well,
right. By the heater.
Right. So
by the window.
But in general, we do not question the consumer whatsoever. Bottle was bad, you get a credit. So, but it's enabled us to increase our business with these older wines. So it's a significant part of our business now, and it's great fun. I mean, my Jamie Wolf just has a ball doing this. So, and he has dinners with these wines frequently, which are always, you know, huge fun for consumers.
Talk to me a bit. I'm just throwing a hook in the water with this one. So I'm ancient, I guess, by modern standards of youth and kids and wine. 60 years old next birthday. So And I've been drinking wine all my life. But when I was a young cook, chef, sous chef coming up, 70s, 80s, into the 90s, as we mentioned early in the show, all the really good restaurants back then were French. I mean, it was Lutèce, La Caravelle, La Côte Possible, blah, blah, blah. I worked at the Four Seasons. I worked at the Maurice with Roger Daghorn. In his early, early days, yeah, he was on the floor with us in the 80s as a somm. I was like, oh, what's a somm? What the hell did I know, right? And what a genius Roger is. But my palate was sort of formed on old world wines. And back then, I mean, you could drink, Burgundy was affordable. You look at the wine lists from Le Cote Basque back in the day, or, you know, any of those restaurants, and it wasn't what it is. It was not, I mean, now it's just for the super rich. I mean, who can afford that? And the same thing with the first. But I grew up drinking Burgundy and Bordeaux and Champagne, because this was what the restaurants were pouring. This is what we were tasting with the chefs. And this is what we were buying in the retail stores that we mentioned earlier. So I kind of came to American wines sideways in a way. New world wines, I'll put it that way. But categorize Americans in there, because that's kind of where I want to focus. And I just could never get used to the style of, how do I put it? Sort of the ebullience, the fruit forward, the sweetness, the use of oak as a flavor component in both reds and whites. And I've always struggled with this idea that, you know, I'm trying to get myself to drink more American wines. And when Pascalino's on the floor at Rouge Tomat, and when she is again, when I go to the restaurants where I know they've got, I said, you know, pour me some American juice. What's happening in the American space that's interesting now? Because there,
it's not really my department.
I know,
though, Mike.
I know, but I'm asking.
Well, last night, Closeron was in pouring. And I'm going to get his name wrong, so I won't even try. But the wines were light, very, very pretty.
From where? California?
Yeah.
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 So there seems to be.
Old Vine Carignan, Old Vine Sanso. These are the grapes that they should be growing in the volcanic schist granite soils in California. They should not be growing Cabernet Sauvignon and Chardonnay. I mean, in general.
Which is what everyone's growing.
But now, it's great to see that there are a lot of people in California now really planting the varietals where they should be. I'm not necessarily in favor of trying to imitate Europe, but making wines that are not so top heavy and very focused. And I mean, you have people like Steve Edmonds, who's been sort of doing that for a long time. Yeah. But now there are a lot of younger people. It's sort of unfortunate that, you know, in order to do that in California, the land prices are crazy.
That's the problem.
You sort of have to have some money, and then you have to charge $50 a bottle to make a living at it. So for me, you know, I admire very much what they're doing. But I mean, when I can sell a biodynamic Beaujolais for $15.
Which you have. You know, have the one that isn't even called Beaujolais. The one that's a funny label. What's it called?
That's Christian Ducru Expectatio.
It's ridiculous. It's crazy. I mean, I bought a few bottles from you, and I fell in love with that wine. It's just crazy. Have you had Cruz Wines from California? Cruz Wine Company, C-R-U-S-E? He does a Gamay. He calls it Val de Gue, which is, I guess, the old word for Gamay in American California. Oh, okay. They're brilliant wines. He's great. And the same thing you're talking about. So it's Gamay. It's done in kind of a very old world style. And I was at a tasting with my son a while back, and we drank some really good. We were with some ballers, and they were paying, and they were opening up some big ass bottles of wine that I knew cost a fortune. And my favorite and his favorite was this 2014 Cruz Gamay, basically, Val de Gue. Just super bright, super alive, super expressive. And I think they're doing really interesting stuff. Finger Lakes and North Fork now, too.
Finger Lakes has great potential, but the weather is just unreliable. You know, I mean, it's probably going to be 10 below up there
tomorrow.
This weekend.
Yeah,
so
I know.
How do you grow, Pinot Noir in those temperatures? I don't know. It's difficult. But they definitely have the terroir for it, and there's a lot of people with skill and commitment trying to do it.
Yeah, I'll never forget one day Pascaline poured me at blind at the old Rouge Tomat uptown. Just pour me a glass of wine. What is it? Why do I sign up for these blind tastings? Why do I let these somms torture me? And I'm swirling it around, and I'm looking at the weight, and looking at the color, and looking at the nose, and I swirl, and I do, and I'm kind of walking in the dark the way you always are. So I'm like, I really like it, like right bank, Merlot driven, fourth growth, something, centennial.
Sounds good.
I don't know. I mean, that's what I'm getting. And she laughed. She said, you're close, but wrong country. And it was Bloomer. No, it wasn't Bloomer Creek. It was called Cheval Blanc. White Horse. It was called White Horse. That was the name of the wine. But it was from the Finger Lakes, and it was a blend of Cab Franc Merlot, grown up there, that was just total old world style. Delicious wine.
Eminence Road is doing nice work in the Finger Lakes. He's a guy that used to be a customer of mine at Garnet, who abandoned his New York life, moved up there, and he's buying grapes from people that are farming well, and he's making really, really beautiful natural
wines. Yeah, Bloomer Creek's from up there, they're doing really nice stuff too, so it's great to see. So let's just go back to Loire for a minute. When we were taking that break before, I told you this summer, I try the last bunch of years to just leave New York the end of June, and I have a house in Cape May, and I just stay put at the beach for 2 months if I can. So, but I got on my radar that Pascaline was doing a tasting at Racine for Cab Franc Loire, and I'm like, Pascaline, I'm signing up. I'll get up early. I'll drive 3 hours, park my car, do the lunch, spit out most of it, drink some coffee, and I'll drive home. And I did. So I drove 3 hours up, 3 hours south to have a 2-hour lunch with Pascaline. And it was maybe 15 people. It was at Racine. It was great. The food was wonderful. But what was funny was I had sort of gone in with, I thought, kind of a working knowledge of Cab Franc and kind of dividing the regions of, Semoule, Chinon, Bergueil, what I had thought. And it would just totally smashed those. What I had in my, just what the, so talk about that grape, because I think that's a grape that Americans have finally warmed to, and there used to be some resistance to that kind of what was considered, like when you go down to Bordeaux and you're looking at underripe fruit, you get that vegetal green pepper thing going, and that tends to present itself in Cab Franc not as a fault, as just part of the quality of the juice, is it has that. I mean, I just call it green pepper because that's what goes off in my nose immediately. Fruit was fine. Fruit was ripe. But those wines to me are so interesting. And again, back to soil type. Talk about those wines, about that grape in the Loire.
Okay, so the grape was maligned in the U.S. press because when those folks were tasting them, it was sort of the low point of Loire Valley history, I think. You're looking, the 70s, 80s. When everyone, most people even there were farming chemically and harvesting by machine and doing all those bad things. That current farming methods with the great producers in the Loire Valley are making Cab Franc that really does. I mean, okay, there's a little bit of a pepper component to it, but it's not that stemmy green pepper thing that Robert Parker was writing about in the 80s or 90s at all. So the terroirs in Chinon are very different. There's, let's say, three main terroir types that produce very different types of wine. I mean, a good producer to understand that with is Bernard Baudry in Chinon, who is certainly one of the very top, if not the... I mean, I don't like to say anyone's the best of anything, but organic farming, do their own compost... obviously, wild yeast, hand harvesting, everything is aged as it should be, depending on the terroir. So, from sandy soils near the Vienne River, sand and gravel soils, they're making Les Granges. Okay, so the wine is relatively soft. It's very fruity. There's no lack of red fruit in this wine. It's just done in inox or in tank or in cement. In cement, it's done in neutral or some old wood. So then there's a cuvée that's done on gravel, which is a soil which there's not that much of it in Chinon, but there are beds of gravel that as you go up from the river. So this is a wine that benefits from aging in wood. So they age it a year to 18 months in old wood, five to 10 year old wood. Les Grézeaux is the name of the cuvée. It's a wine that can be drunk when it's young because the fruit is so vivacious and lush, but it also ages for 20 to 30 years due to the acidity, due to the natural tannins in the wine, not due to wood tannins whatsoever. So then you have, the most famous terroirs of Chinon are tuff on limestone, the variations in the types of limestone with clay, and the clay can be sandy, it can have stones mixed in, depending on where you are. Le Picasse is a famous vintage vineyard of this type. The village of Saint-Louis has this textbook clay soil over limestone that makes very long aging wines. For the Beaudries, they have a vineyard called Quaboise, which is on a hillside near the town of Chinon, which, again, a little sandy in parts, but mostly deep clay. Their Clos Guillot is a similar terroir. And these are wines that are tannic when they're young, that age beautifully for 20 to 30 years. And those wines are aged in wood, aged 2 to 6 years of age, roughly. So they're pairing the terroir with the way they're aging it. And they're producing four really distinctly different types of wine from the terroirs of Chinon. Sommer Champigny, you have a little different limestone there, and you've got a lot of clay over it. Saumur is a very different terroir, which I've never cared for so much for the reds. And then you got Bourgogne and Saint-Nicolas de Bourgogne on the other side of the river. Why is there Saint-Nicolas de Bourgogne? Well, it's because the mayor wanted his own appellation, so he got it. So they're really basically the same, but it's a very interesting, it's a much easier terroir to look at because it's a gradual slope up from the Loire River, very gradual, sort of flat looking, and then with a bit of a hill that shields the vineyards from the north wind. So you have a very warm microclimate as you go up this small hill at the end. And it's sort of a Burgundian idea in the different positions on the slope in Bourgogne. But the basic idea is sand in the lower level, some gravel, particularly in Saint-Nicolas, and then that heavy clay limestone soil that produces the aging wines.
And aren't they using chestnut sometimes for the barrels there?
Not anymore? Occasionally, but yeah, I don't see that much anymore, no.
Okay,
no.
They used to.
Could be, yeah.
Okay.
No, I don't know.
And the barrels that they're using are older?
Older and generally larger. I mean, the Foucaults and Sommer Champigny are the famous example of new oak, or 1 or 2 year old that they buy from First Growth in Bordeaux. I mean, those wines are brilliant. I mean, they stay in barrel for 2.5 years. And he was very careful explaining that to me, a long time ago, that you need to leave the wine in the barrel long enough for it to round out, to really blend, to incorporate the wood tannins.
Right, so it becomes a spherical tasting wine and not one of these wines with edges and bleh.
It's become crazy. I mean, you can't even buy the wines anymore. I mean, I sort of lose interest. It's one of the great estates of France, but as a wine merchant, I'm tending as I get older to sort of lose interest in the wines that become priced where only hedge fund traders can buy them. And I mean, that's why I really enjoy. Finding wines that we can sell for $10 to $15 that provide the consumer with this experience.
It's astonishing. It's astonishing. Sorry to interrupt you, but I mean, my price range is like, there's no bottom, but of course, the bottom's wherever I can find something wonderful. But $15 to $30 in that zone. Yeah. There's so much good wine available in New York now. It's just crazy. Like, you kind of have to be, I don't want to say nuts. I mean, you can go a little north of 30. I mean, funny, we've watched Cru Beaujolais sort of do that price creep, right? I mean, Cru Beaujolais, I was there for the harvest in 05, and they were pushing the low 20s then for really good wine. And now it's kind of low 30s.
Yeah, but it's still
value.
If you have to pay $35 for the Foyard Morgon 2014, the wine is beautiful.
It's insane. I agree. It's worth twice as much. I love the idea of paying 18 and not 32. Yeah. But your store, and I say this to everybody, because the New York market is so attractive, because America is attractive, but specifically our market, it's like an embarrassment of riches what's available here from everywhere.
Yeah. People walk into our store, but they could do the same thing at Flatiron or Crusher, any number of stores in New York. And, Europeans walk in, winemakers walk
in. Jaws
drop. Oh, my God, I've never seen this. So, no, it's fun.
Yeah, Crush is great. It's a shop there. So 57th right off 3rd Avenue. A little more expensive than you. So must be the
I don't know that it's more expensive. They cater to very rare wines.
Yeah. And we never really talk. I mean, Chenin Blanc, you had a great piece on Riesling. So some chef, you have someone's, you're selling kind of nice older vintages of Riesling that was someone's collection. That was a cool thing to see.
And
the internet's a big part of your business now, isn't it?
It's about 55-60% now.
Because you had something. You had an Italian white, I forget the varietal. This is embarrassing, but I remember reading something. I don't know that varietal. This sounds really good. And I literally was at your store like that day or within 48 hours, and you had sold out.
Right. That can be irritating. I like, with my offers, I like to try to at least get a few bottles out there to everybody that wants it. But it's sort of hard because that requires a lot of effort to call people, hey, I've got this cool thing and you should really try it. But, right. You know.
No, I'm lose your snooze, man. That's what happens.
Yeah.
I got there
but
late.
People can get angry sometimes. It's too bad.
It's New York. People get angry. And to your age-worthy thing, I was Patrick Capiello does these renegade wine dinners at Pearl and Ash a bunch of times during the year. And I love Patrick. He's one of these great, you know, young rock starry guys. And so the theme that night was just France, all over France. And I don't know how many wines we had, but it was my son and I, and then it was a couple from Connecticut we were kind of sharing the table with. And he had been in the wine business, which is explained why he would be there that night. And we get them the meal, and he had so much fun just because my son, he'd crack up. But you work with kids like this. You know, kids in the 20s that are into wine, they just can talk about it endlessly. And my son just like that. And they were like, you know, he just started drinking wine a couple of years ago, but his learning curve, he's really on it. So this guy had so much fun with us. He went, he said, let's not leave. Let me buy a bottle. Went to the bar, ordered a bottle of wine, and it was a Chenal from the late 70s. I think it was a 79. And I'm not sure who the winemaker was. I think it was a woman. Olga Raffo?
Olga Raffo, yeah.
That's who it was.
She's not alive anymore, but it's the name of the estate.
It's the name of the estate. But it was a 79, and it was fucking beautiful, man. 79. So I can't do the math, but sorry. Did I just curse? Liz looked at me. Oh, no. yeah, right. Like, that's the first time.
The first time I went to Olga Raffo, it was the first time they had exported to the United States. It was with an importer named Alain Janganet. And the winemaker, Olga's husband, who's German, who was a German prisoner of war, who was a prisoner in the Loire Valley, who somehow got a job there, and Olga's husband died suddenly in 46, I think, and Ernest became the winemaker, just took over. And it's an amazing story, and he became really one of the great winemakers of Chenal. But this was probably in 1990 or 91, and he started going in the cellar and bringing back older and older wines. But many of them were from really crappy vintages. And they were light, but they were ethereal and delicate and complex. And I had never experienced this before in my life. It was a real eye-opener. It was fabulous.
That's something. Pleasure to have you on, man. Thanks for coming out today. David Lilly, the name of the store is Chamber Street Wines, really a gem. The wine bar two blocks to the east of it on that same street on Church is Racine. Just such a great place to – great food, super wine, super knowledgeable staff. I mean, you just go there and it's like going to school and eating three-star food while you're at it. It's great. Keep up the great work.
Great.
Thanks.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks for all you do.
Thanks for having me on.
Stay tuned, folks. We've got more chaos next week. And I want to give a big shout-out to Liz. Liz, our girl here, she's been my producer since I started here 3 years ago. She's a pip. She's so cool. She was a golfer in college. She's a free spirit. She's got a big dog, lives on the Upper West Side, loves New York City, and she just got herself a real-ass job. That's right. She got a real-ass radio job working for the man. She's going to work for Bloomberg. I love it. Good for you, Liz. Congratulations to Liz Smith. Little round of applause there. Good luck, Liz.
HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.